On this episode of The Midwife's Cauldron, we take a whistle-stop tour of breastfeeding from hundreds, if not thousands, of years ago, up until the modern day. We learn how the fashionable corsets of the day could have led to inverted nipples and far worse, the six specifications to become a wet nurse, and whether Rachel fits the mould, and some of the hilarious and gruesome recipes of low milk supply and sore nipples. So stay tuned for a leap into the fascinating world of feeding babies. I'm Katie James, and this is the Midwives Cauldron Podcast. Each episode, I'm joined by my incredible co-host, Dr. Rachel Reed. Listen in as we hubble, bubble, toil and trouble our way through aspects of womanhood, midwifery, birth and lactation. So go on, subscribe now, and hear us on your favourite podcast host.
Well, tell me a breast story. Because I don't really know a lot about breastfeeding. I kind of, that's not my area. Although, you know, I looked after women who breastfeed, but it's not really my area of deep knowledge. So I'd really like to hear about the history of breastfeeding.
Great. I love it. And the history of breastfeeding is kind of interesting, a bit gruesome. So I'm going to take you on a little tale today, Rachel. And start as far back as we know, and actually we've started to see from artifacts from about 3000 BC of how we cared for our infants. And really this is pretty similar to how we've always been doing it for millennia, which is not any great shakes or anything surprising, but actually what we saw at the beginning has completely changed to where we are now and changed to the last century. So of course, when we talked about the Hearst story, we talked a bit about the sculptures of the goddesses and how they would always
breasts, didn't they?
They definitely had breasts, Rachel. They had a lot of breasts, and women and the goddesses were always impicted.
Yeah, that's a word. We'll have that one.
All right. Impicted.
Yeah.
Here we go. Here's Katie with her great word knowledge. That's not even correct terminology anyway. Word knowledge. Thesaurus. Thank you. So, so the goddesses. What I know.
Impiction is a better word than depiction. I like it. Let's use it.
That's what it is. Depiction. Do you know, this is so unfair. So was my morning. Like,
do you know? Yeah, but it's my end of the day when my brain's gone.
It's not end of the day. It's like 3 p.m. It's not end of the day.
Yeah. What? It is for my brain. I have a window between 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock where my brain works. The rest of it's just fucked.
So basically, we've got either end of the scale with us. No wonder this is what comes out on this podcast.
I know. But I'm thinking we could make our own dictionary, the Midwife's Cauldron Dictionary, because we come up with a new word every week.
We do. We should actually be writing them down. I hope one of the listeners is actually writing down the new words that we've been showing, and it'll be the new Midwife's Dictionary. Forget that little pocket dictionary that everyone carries around. It's the Katie and Rachel Pictionary. No, dictionary. It should be a Pictionary one as well. Anyway, back to goddesses. As we know, goddesses were always depicted with breasts, large breasts, and holding babies and breastfeeding. That was the norm. And what is lovely is that, and actually we've seen this in research, that women tend to do it anyway, but in the sculptures, the goddesses are always holding the baby to the left side. So the head, the baby's being held in the left arm, the head is by the left side because it's closest to the heart. And we actually, there's been some research looking at women, how most women will naturally hold the baby in this position, or most of the time, if that's an opportunity. So the baby is closer to the heart, which I find quite fascinating, really. And so that's impicted, depicted, whatever we want to use. in the goddess sculptures as well. So, and really, you know, breastfeeding was totally the norm, like birth was. Women were revered for their abilities to create and to bring about this life and to feed it and nurture it with their own milk. So milk was also revered. And really wet nurses came onto the scene because if a mother died in childbirth or she was unwell or her milk didn't come in for whatever reason, then a wet nurse would be called in. Which makes perfect sense because there would be other women who were breastfeeding within society.
So when I think of wet nurses, I think of kind of the Middle Ages onwards, but is there evidence that those wet nurses before that?
Yes. And that's the thing. We always think about the Middle Ages, really. And that's why I wanted to have a bit of a look what had been going on. And actually, we've seen that really we've got wet nurses as far back as ancient Mesopotamia. And they have even found that there was legal contracts drawn up at that time between wet nurse and the family. And wow. Even what would happened to some of the pharaohs in Egypt was they would have a high-born wet nurse, and this wet nurse would be used exclusively for royalty and the high-born, and they would enjoy incredibly high status being the royalty's wet nurse. And so they've even seen evidence that some of those wet nurses would have been at, you know, the funeral gatherings, which were some of the biggest gatherings that would happen. And they were allowed to call themselves the milk sister of the king because they were in that high regard because they fed and nurtured the king.
So why were they brought in then? Was it because the queen or whoever the mother couldn't feed, or was it because there was some kind of status in not feeding? Like, why weren't women breastfeeding their own babies?
Yeah, that is the ultimate question. And I'm going to get onto that. And mostly at that time, it was if there was a reason why they couldn't breastfeed. There's also some evidence of sharing of breastfeeding. But again, that far back, it's tricky for us to actually pinpoint until we start to get more records from really the last century. So from like 1100s onwards, then we're seeing more records of what was happening with wet nurses within society. And this definitely became about the wealthy, about society. But initially, again, that was just continued. It was if the mother couldn't breastfeed for whatever reason, or if she died in childbirth, if they needed to feed the baby, then they would call for a wet nurse. But really, we start to see that wet nurses are being recorded more and more around the middle part of the 1300s. And in France, they started to record how much they were paid. And we can see in the records that wet nurses from this point and onwards would always be better paid than the servants. And so wet nursing was considered in some respects a better job because you would be well paid. And there was different varieties throughout the years over this sort of course of about 500 years of whether a wet nurse would have to live in with the family or whether they would live outside and the baby would be sent to the wet nurse. And sometimes this was up to 40 miles away. And you can imagine back in the sort of 15, 1600s, 40 miles away is an incredible, it's a day's journey on a horse. Mm. And so they wouldn't actually see their child until they came back from being wet nursed. And so This is when we start to see all these rules get laid down and society changes. And really this was for the wealthy, the upper classes would have wet nurses.
Was that because breastfeeding was seen as something that was dirty or something lower class?
We'll be right back.
I just wanted to pop into your luggles and tell you about my brand spanking new podcast, The Feeding Couch. This podcast ain't just designed with pregnant women or new parents in mind, but also for all of us working in the space of birth work. This is the podcast where I hand the mic over to a different mom, dad, parent, or even grandparent to take us on their feeding journey. Every story matters. It's often through hearing others' experiences where we find our own inner knowledge, strength, and courage. Listen in to hear the stories told of triumph, challenge, heartwarming, tear-jerking, fist-pumping, and how we each deal with our venture into this new world emotionally, socially, and physically. Whether you're a student, a newbie midwife, doula, lactation exam prepper, or just hungry for more knowledge, these stories will also give you a backstage pass to the global lactation clinic. Whether you're pregnant and seeking information or supporting those on their journey, I can't wait to see you on the couch with me soon. Oh, and a little favour, your reviews on Apple Podcasts mean the world. They're like magic beans that help spread the podcast out for those who need to hear it. Let's make this something amazing together. Yes, there's quite a few reasons that women chose not to breastfeed. And actually what we see is it is pretty similar to what gets said now. And, you know, they talked about how it would have an impact on their health. And I'm going to talk about that because that's actually really important. Their figure and their beauty. And also there's a great quote from a book called Breast Bottles and Babies by Valerie Fields. It's a wonderful book that I actually found in a charity shop many years ago. And it's from the 80s. And she has just done this huge, incredible, like essay, thick tome of a book into what has been going on throughout the ages. It's fascinating. But she said that also these women thought that breastfeeding would make them look old before their time. So we're hearing this. And the other thing was that women said they can't dress fashionably. Because if you think about it, it was all about corsets. And can you imagine trying to get out? Imagine the layers. Like they would put on these undergarments and then they would put on another garment on top and then they'd be laced into this corset and then they'd have the dress on top and then they'd push the bosoms up. Can you imagine trying to breastfeed like every time? Get your tatas out and like, oh, there we go again, every hour and a half. And it would take 15 minutes for the maid to undress you, get a boob out.
Could you not just pop it over the top?
You probably could, because they were almost showing their nipples in about 1600s.
No, we're not in the old days when they were wearing it.
So, yeah, I think that would be great. But yes. And the other thing was they had fear about sagging and scarred breasts as well through this period. That really through the 15 to 1800s, the loads of midwifery textbooks had so much information dedicated to the diseases of the breasts and nipples and the remedies. So you can imagine the fear that it actually instilled, because this is when women started to read as well. And throughout this period, we see a lot of the textbooks only aimed at the medical men. And then they started to write around about the 1800s, started to write, you know, the care of infants and books that women of higher class and higher breed were meant to start reading as well. And I want to go back because I mentioned that they worried about their health. And this was really interesting to me because often these women were seen as too weak to, you know, care for their children sufficiently. And this was often said by the religious factions of the day of these high-born women. They're too weak. They can't breastfeed. They should be breastfeeding their infants. But actually, when we look at it, because they were using wet nurses, they weren't having this contraceptive effect that you get from exclusive and long-term breastfeeding. And so we see a big difference between the amount of babies the wealthy had compared to, you know, the washerwoman or the country folk who might have 4 to 6 babies. Mm. It was very common for the rich wealthy to be having 10, 12 children. And it wasn't uncommon for them to be reports that they were having up to 30 children or more than 20.
What?
During that lifespan, she was pregnant almost continuously. The other thing was that the wealthy women were not having a good diet. The women working on the land were eating vegetables and things like that, but they were having these rich, wealthy diets. So actually they were deficient in minerals and vitamins. They were often losing blood and they weren't actually fit to breastfeed. They were exhausted. Can you imagine 20 babies? Like, and really, what was the life expectancy around that point? What, 45, 50 maybe? And then how many children would they lose? All this bacteria, these diseases. So there's there really was an actual reason for these women to not breastfeed, or the fact that they didn't actually have enough milk because they were just exhausted. No wonder they sat around all day in Jane Austen's thing, just crocheting. That's all they could do.
Sounds good.
I'm not sure. I don't think I want to change it, to be honest. 12 kids.
Yeah.
No.
No, just the crocheting.
Just the crocheting. Yeah. I don't think you're going to get one without the other.
Yeah.
The other thing that's really fascinating is when we talk about the fashion, there's a lot of these women that it's reported that they would say they had no nipples. And they think what they meant by that was that they were inverted and that they couldn't suckle their infants. But actually, when they've looked back at the fashions and they look at these corsets, because the corsets were made of metal or hard leather or even bone, and they were pulled in so tightly every single day, that actually they were flattening their nipples, because they were being put in these corsets from the age of 2.5 to 3. So they went through puberty being completely squished in and confining their ability to grow or breathe. And there's even reported cases of fatalities whereby the corsets are so tight, they've cracked a rib and the rib's gone into the lung and caused...
What?
Yeah. So this would happen to children sometimes. And we had deformities of the breasts and the nipples, which actually caused another reason why they couldn't breastfeed. So yet again, fashion and to look good for society is impacting on breastfeeding. Sound familiar?
Yeah. And Marilyn French writes about this, saying that there's always been, in terms of stratification of status, women who hold status in communities, there's always been fashions that constrain them. That's been a sign of status. Mm-hmm. So whether that's corsets or foot binding or very shoes, high heels, or that women who are at higher status, it's almost like a status symbol to say, well, I can be really uncomfortable. I don't need to work in the fields and have my body function in a way that's comfortable.
Yes, absolutely. And that we've seen since really things started to change with the church. As goddesses, and then, you know, if we look at those sculptures and those depictions, the women are in free-flowing clothing, the breasts are revered in whatever state and form they are, and the natural ability of women is looked upon highly. But when we come into this society from sort of 1100s onwards, 1300s, 1500s, it's really about fashion, how we look. And then, of course, it becomes about what religion says. And then the other reason why women don't want to breastfeed is because apparently the father had desire for sexual relations. And until around about, I think it's about 1500, the church actually said that while the infant is breastfeeding, you have to abstain from sexual relations. So that wouldn't have gone down well.
So that right there is a reason for wet nursing.
Yeah, I mean, out of everything, you can imagine the pressure. And then it became that it was the wet nurse would have these contracts drawn up, and she wasn't allowed to have relations with her partner because they thought it would spoil or harm the milk. So, yeah, I mean, if you had not a great husband, you would might be happy to be brought into the house and not have relations. But if you were just one of the country women who was God knows how many children she was wet nursing at the time, and she just took these kids 30 miles away, I'm sure that she didn't abide by the rules of not having sex. But, you know, it's just amazing what goes on, and because we were told what to do. And that goes all the way through society. Following what, you know, the kings and the queens and the high on the nobility did, and then that follows down. And what we see is even around 1500s or late 1500s, we see that women who weren't even of such high status, so women whose perhaps their husbands were shopkeepers, even they were choosing to have wet nurses because it made them look like they had a higher status.
Wow. So it's like the women who have a higher status would invite the male midwife with all of his instruments because that meant you were high status.
Yep. It was about how we looked to society so that we can fit in. And the thing is, when things started to change back to being more recommendation in the middle 1800s, they started to see that the infant mortality rate was increasing from alternative feeding methods, dry nursing, which we'll talk about. So if we look at the 1800s, it became that it was almost just part of society that everybody wanted a wet nurse and to bring them up to status as much as possible. But towards the end of the late 1700s, early 1800s, we start to see a change that more women are thinking or starting to breastfeed their own infants. And it was becoming a bit more acceptable for upper class women to do this. But guess what they were coping with? The older women from society, the mother-in-law, the mother, goading them and telling them, why would you want to breastfeed? They had to overcome this opposition of older women who had brought up their children using wet nurses. So we just keep repeating ourselves we're always trying to be able to do what we want to do, or we're actually always trying to go back to what feels right. Because can you imagine, like, we talk about this and we're laughing about it as in they had no feelings, but these women were having, because of society, because of what they were conformed to in terms of the dress, the religious beliefs, the belief of society, they had to have their infants brought up by other women. Now, there is reports of some women half breastfeeding their own child and half sharing it with the wet nurse because of a preventative measure if the mother died or if the wet nurse died or if the wet nurse got infected, because they believe that if the infant got ill, it was the milk of the wet nurse that was the problem. So actually they would treat the wet nurse before the infant, before they had that knowledge of antibodies or bacteria or what was going in. It's sort of insightful thinking that there is protection. It's seen as white blood, an essential part for infants. And at least that was known. But the actual pain and the problems in bonding with their child, you know, the fact that the pharaohs would allow the wet nurse to call her, the king would be able to call her the milk sister, shows how important this relationship is that a child has with the person they feed from. The other thing is they would have been passing on the genetics of the wet nurse through the milk, because that's continuously passing through those epigenetics, we're passing through those modifications that are specific to that woman, because our expression, the DNA or the changes and the different components of our breast milk is specific to us, depending on where we live, our history, what country we live in, the foods we eat. So these infants were having 6 months, 12 months longer away from their actual mother. Can you imagine the infant then being brought back as like a small toddler and going, well, this is your mother now? Like, no wonder we have this sort of strange society. And you look back at the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s at this high-born nobility, and they do seem a little odd.
They do, but it's also interesting that the generation before the current generation feels the need to influence towards what they did often, even if what they did wasn't best. And it's almost like, and I feel like it's a protective mechanism, you know, when you have mothers that are almost sabotaging their daughters breastfeeding because they didn't breastfeed. And really to acknowledge that I didn't breastfeed for whatever reason, because I wasn't given the right information or support. And that was, you know, and so my baby didn't get breast milk. That's really hard to deal with. And it's almost easier to say, and it doesn't make any difference and it doesn't matter. So you should also bottle feed, because it's really confronting to watch you do the thing that I couldn't do.
Yep. And I think, you know, having worked in this field for a long time, I speak to women, whether they perhaps are the grandparents or friends or people who, again, have older children who maybe are having their own children now. And they're becoming grandparents. And if I've gone in and given help or support, there's much discussion of, I wish I'd known this. And a lot of the time, women still say that word, which is, I feel so guilty that I didn't give my daughter breast milk. I wish I'd known. And I think the guilt thing is a big thing that I want to get rid of, because you only do what you know at the time. And, you know, when we know better, or when we're helped, or when we're supported, then we can, of course, do better. But if we're in this society that doesn't support women, doesn't give them information thing, and that's what we're struggling with now, is a society where we know that breastfeeding is the ideal, but we're still in this position where we don't have the right amount of support, or the correct support being given all the time. And then we have misinformation from previous generations who perhaps feel guilty, feel sad, and feel this real pain of not being able to have had their own chance and experience to breastfeed. And it's a difficult one to move through. It's very difficult to be a daughter, or to be a woman who's breastfeeding, and to be surrounded by information that's coming at you and comments that are coming at you that are negative, or meant in a nice way, but have an undertone of discrediting your ability or your knowledge, or that how could you know anything because you're a brand new mother. It doesn't help, clearly. And we've been seeing that from time immemorial in sort of this highborn society of where there was money and there was class and there was status and there was something to prove. What I do want to tell you about, though, is the characteristics they had for wet nurses, because these are marvelous. And it depends where you look in the world and also at what time. But so if you go from places like Turkey and Greece over to India, to Europe, to Britain, there was all different specifics. What? It was different desires for...
specifications.
Thank you. Jesus. How do I even have a job? I mean, really? God, there were different specifications, thank you, teacher, for what they would look for in a wet nurse. So, I mean, if you didn't fit these features, oh, your career as wet nurse is well over. I'm sorry. So, really, they would put it down into six categories. And they were looking at body size, the breasts, the nipples, a woman's temperament.
Oh, okay.
They would test her milk, and also they would make sure that she was having no sex. So I'm going to just talk you through some of the varieties of women who would have been seen as acceptable. And this is from a range of countries and throughout sort of...
Just in case anybody out there is thinking of applying for a job as a wet nurse. I did actually have a friend who said that was the ideal job.
I mean, yeah, I can imagine there's so many women who would love that. And actually, I have heard, and I've looked it up years ago, I don't know if it is still there, because someone had told me that actually there is a place in the UK where you can go and get your servants and your butlers. It's like a specific website for very wealthy people. And they now is the role of wet nurse, that you can actually hire a wet nurse. So it does still exist in Britain. I'm going to have to go and look that up again, because it's been at least 5-6 years since I went on that website. I can't remember what it was, but I reckon I'm going to do a Google search for butlers in Britain, see if I can get a wet nurse.
Do it, because a lot of women really like breastfeeding, don't they?
Yes, there's lots of women who like breastfeeding. Thank goodness. No,
I mean, I did it, but I certainly wouldn't want to actually do it as a job. Like, that was enough. Do what you need to do. End. Not now doing it with somebody else.
Exactly. Bugger off. I'm not breastfeeding your kid. I mean, like anything, there's some of us who absolutely love it. And when they're, you know, I've spoken to women who are on their second or third child, and they know that this is probably going to be their last child, and they don't want to stop breastfeeding. And that weaning process can be a real grief of losing something. And there's other women who are, you know, gritting their teeth, and it's not painful necessarily, but it's not pleasant, or it's not something they desire to do for years. And, you know, they're like, I'm going to get myself to 4 months or 6 months, and they breastfeed, and they have given their child this milk that they were able to give, and they've done it. And then there's, of course, other women on completely the other end of the scale that have had a really tricky birth and labor, like we've talked about, have not had the right intervention and support and care to get and make enough milk early on in the beginning. And, you know, they've had to their whole breastfeeding journey's mucked up before they've even started. And these women are grieving the loss that they weren't even able to breastfeed. So this whole spectrum is huge and a tricky one, and one that we will continue to talk about throughout these podcasts, because it's just, it's epic. And it's as big as, you know, talking about the types of birth that people have.
It is. But more importantly, Katie, tell me what the list is for a wet nurse.
Tell me if you could fit into this. Tell me if you could be a wet nurse, your body size.
I can tell you now. No. All right.
I think the temperament, why you're definitely not going to have body size, large frame, fleshy and strong, broad chest, not too fat, but not too thin. Some like a large chest, not too fat or thin, or some like a well-developed muscular body and strong neck. Can you fit into those categories?
Well, I've got wide shoulders.
You've got broad shoulders. I mean, maybe that's a tick. Yeah. Maybe there was a scale of like 1 to 5, and then they just had, you know, like in a police, not police academy. What do they call it? A police lineup, you know, like in the bad guys in American movies, and you have to pick out the one. Maybe they would line up the wet nurses all standing with a number, and then they ticked off. They had like a little tick chart. She scores a 3 for broad chested. She's fleshy. She gets a 4. Oh, she's a bit thin, only a 1 for her. And then they go on to breasts. So the breasts should be medium-sized, soft, and unwrinkled. They could also want large breasts. Some people wanted, very specifically, not too small and not too large. So why don't they just say medium-sized?
So just breasts, basically.
So very specific. So where are we on our lineup? And then nipples. They were very specific. Again, medium-sized nipples, not too porous. Now, for me, porous is like how, like a sponge that absorbs water. What do they do? Pour water on it and just see whether it soaks the water in, or whether they're like a duck and the water just rolls off.
What is a porous nipple? That is bizarre. Answers on a postcard.
Yeah. I bet there's a lactation consultant will go, Katie, you should know this, and a porous nipple means blah, blah, blah. But I am talking about 1500 porous. And then some of them wanted them not too compact. I'm assuming they mean not retracted or not inverted. Oh, and then the other side is, we're still on nipples. I love a good nipple. And not turned aside. So if one nipple's looking at you and one's not looking at you, you're out. Line up. You score a 0.
Interesting, because your breasts change.
Of course they do. And the amount of breasts and nipples I've seen, thousands, I can tell you, there's not many that are going to fit into that category. And nipples come in all shapes and sizes. They look in all different directions. Actually, all our breasts are different sizes, some more noticeable than others. And so's the areola and the nipple as well.
All right. Well, let's move on from breasts then. What's the next category?
Temperament. Uh-oh. Rachel's not going to fit in here, because your temperament and behavior should be chaste, cheerful, sober, good moral character, not mentally deranged, not emotional, not given to lewdness or drunkenness, and not a prostitute.
Yeah, no, I'm out.
I think we're both out. And abstinence of sex, remember, because otherwise you're going to harm the child through breastfeeding, because your milk will be different and it will stimulate menstruation, and that. And pregnancy is harmful to a child who is breastfeeding, apparently. The other thing is they test her milk. And sometimes they would just test on, like, you know, the police lineup. You're in, you've made it. The voice, you're the wet nurse today for this baby. But sometimes they would actually keep testing her milk, like every month, to check that it was okay.
Well, hang on. Testing it how?
Well, they would look at the colour and the appearance. And they would do a taste, smell, consistency test. And then they'd write it down and record it. Yeah, they would.
Ooh, a bit strawberry.
A bit garlic. Oh, what were you eating, love?
Or worse, I'm gonna go there. Oh, I could taste some sperm in this one. You've not been chased.
Brilliant. So, yes. I'm not sure you're going to make the police academy lineup, Rachel, of wet nurses, and I might choose a different one. Rachel, I need to tell you about the remedies for sore nipples or what they did to increase milk supply, because some of these are just really fit into that sort of gruesome tale of 500 years ago, 400 years ago. So I'm going to go to Egypt first, and then I'm going to come back to pretty much Europe. So back in the 16th century in Egypt, this is one of my favorite recipes. It's just said a recipe for the breast. It doesn't say what it is, but firstly, they use calamine. Very nice. Wonderful. But then they mix to it gallbladder of ox, flies, dirt. What is flies dirt? How do you collect that? Like, when a fly lands, does it leave a bit of dirt that you have to go around with a tiny dustpan and brush and just like collect it? What is it? What's flies dirt?
I don't know.
Or is it like they're maggots?
Or is it their poop?
Have you ever seen a fly poop? No. Now you're thinking. Exactly. I mean, I know that they vomit before they eat your food.
What?
Yeah, that's why flies are dirty. So anyway, they mixed it with flies dirt, whatever that was. Maybe it was dead flies and they just crushed them up. They just went around, they were doing the dusting and they found the dust and the dead flies on the windowsill and they just gathered it in, thought that'll do nicely. And then they'd mix it with yellow ochre, which would make it obviously look quite pretty. Mm-hmm. And then they would rub it on the breast for 4 days. Leave it there. Lovely. Just keep doing the dusting. The house was very clean on these days because they were just getting all that fly dirt.
All right. No, I don't like that.
No, I didn't think you'd like that. I mean, at least they didn't make you eat it, which is a plus, because some of these recipes you're meant to ingest. So here we go. Get ready. Yeah. Hold your britches. Britches? Brooches. What is it? Britches.
I don't know if that's the right word, but I know what you mean.
Hold your britches. Get ready.
Hold your hair on.
Hold your hat on. So hold your hair on. Why would you hold your hair on? Your head's connected to your head. It's hold your hat.
That's what you... No.
It's hold your...
You don't. You say hold your hair on. When somebody's having a rad, you go, hold your hair on, because the hair's going to come off because they're radging.
Hold your hat on because of the wind. I don't know.
No, I'm going to prove you wrong.
All right, you proved me wrong. But right, listen to my story. Obviously, women had the same problems that we have now. Like, they had low milk supply, they had sore nipples. So they had to think about ways, obviously. They were looking at ways of increasing milk supply. And the first one is fennel seed, and we use fennel now. Anise. And then they would put this all together with powdered crystal, cow's udders or hooves, the broth of tongue, and powdered earthworms. To make it nice,
no!
They'd put some parsnip and dill in there.
Trigger warning. You cannot talk about earthworms. That's a knot. See, I need to hold my hair on now because I'm going to be
sick. But they're powdered, so it's all right. Cow's udders and powdered earthworms.
No. I have a phobia about earthworms.
I don't know you've got a phobia about worms.
Well, you don't know me then.
I don't know you. That's it. Podcast over.
It's very serious.
I'm sorry I'm laughing at your phobia, but just bear with me because I'm either going to give you the option to eat this or I can apply it to your breast. Which one are you choosing?
I'll have it applied to my breast, please, but I have no earthworms in it.
I'm sorry. I'm the doctor and what I say goes. So I've made the concoction of this. And, you know, do you want milk or not? Oh. So powdered earthworms it is. Or there is an alternative I can offer you, and that is that I can get someone from the village or in your local family to suck your breasts themselves.
That would depend on who it was. Can I choose who?
I'm not sure. It wasn't stated in the textbook, so I would assume you could, but who knows? It just said either another person. The other option is any young animal, preferably a puppy, to suckle. And as we get further on in history, we did actually have the first breast pumps, which are awesome. They are made of glass. And so they sort of vacuum onto the breast. I mean, there's not really a great vacuum, but there's a space for the breast. I mean, if your breast doesn't fit into this glass structure, then you're really in a bit of peril. And then there's this huge tube that comes up to the woman's mouth where she sucks. I can imagine this, you'd have a bit of a headache from sucking for quite a long time to get the milk flowing. There's some good pictures. I'll put them on Instagram. So that's how they would increase your milk supply.
No, I think I'd stay puppy. Yeah,
I think I'd go puppy too.
Yeah, get yourself a puppy. Okay.
I'll get you a puppy, darling, for your low milk supply. I wonder if that would work now as my lactation consulting. And I'd just be like, you know what?
Oh, it probably would go down really
Forget
well.
Forget the pumps. Get a puppy. They're brilliant. They love a bit of milk. Go for it. It's not weird. Let me know how you go with that. Not sure about a bacteria as well. So
awesome.
I'm not recommending this, listeners. I'm just reporting on what was done many years ago. This is definitely not up-to-date scientific evidence. Just a disclaimer from me there. So sore nipples. So we've cured your low milk supply. We've cured whatever the problem was with your breast in Egypt with the fly dirt. And now I'm going to help you with the sore nipples because sore nipples could get pretty bad back in the day because obviously we didn't really wash our hands. And so you can imagine the infection rate was not pretty. And so often their nipples would develop ulcers. Also, of course, milk fever, mastitis and abscesses, which actually carried a really high mortality rate. But actually there was reported that there was quite frequent loss of the entire nipple.
Oh, what?
For women. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sure you don't want the powdered earthworms?
Oh,
I mean,
don't know. Still not going there. I'll just not have a nipple.
I think I'd go powdered earthworms and the fly dirt. Give it to me if it's going to stop me. Actually, I'd just go washing my hands, to be honest, but that wasn't really an option in those days. So, these poor women often would sort of lose their nipples or their nipples would be really quite damaged severely. And often, of course, they're having several babies if they are breastfeeding at that point. So they made nipple shields. And we see reference for nipple shields from very early on, but we really have good existing nipple shields from like the 1500s. I'm fascinated by these because there's loads of different types of nipple shields. But when you think about, and I'm going to tell you what they're made of, it is absolutely incredible that any baby could get any milk out of them because they were made from things like tin. Okay, not that strong a metal, but wood, ivory. My favorite is lead because you definitely want to put lead on your breast and in your baby's mouth because they weren't just putting lead in the makeup on their faces and dying from it. They were also putting it on their nipples.
My God.
But if you were very posh, you would have a silver nipple shield, a glass nipple shield because that's really nice to suck on. It could be made of horn. I think that's just for the poor people would have made a horn one or bone. Or sometimes the doctor would or the midwife would make a self-made, which is actually quite nice. It would be made to her nipple, made to measure out of wax. And then they poke some holes in it.
Oh, no, that's quite clever.
That seems the best option. Very clever. Mm. That's how, I mean, if your nipple had actually fallen off because it was so infected, you could just stick a lead fake nipple on. And off you go. Jobs are good.
And then Madonna did it years later in a music video.
So, I mean, that was if you survived breastfeeding and your nipple didn't fall off and you had access to a wet nurse, then you're okay. But, you know, there were some infants that didn't have that opportunity and would need other feeding methods. And this is when we talk about dry feeding. And also alternative feeding in terms of using milk from other animals. And we found in infant graves from as back as 4000 BC, feeding vessels for feeding the infants the milk of other animals. And it was often using an animal's horn. And because that was easy to find, and we would have been surrounded by goats and sheep. And also we see Roman records had actually developed the horn and developed some kind of nipple or teat for the infant to suckle through easier than directly from the horn. Because you can imagine the horn would just be quite fast flowing. But we don't really see sucking bottles until about the 15th century from Germany. And then where we see the biggest use of these sort of alternative feeding methods in this time period, because obviously this was the time when most people would have gone out and got a wet nurse. But really where we're seeing this is for infants who were foundlings, infants who had been abandoned. And also we have to remember that syphilis was quite prevalent. And so a wet nurse would refuse a child who was born with syphilis. And so these children were fed the milk of other animals, or this is when we start seeing them being fed pap.
What's pap?
Pap is a mixture of milk from another animal or gruel, or mixed with breadcrumbs or flour and other additives. Not sure what the additives were. Perhaps it was some fly dirt or powdered earthworms. So there was pap, and there was also panana. And this consisted of broth, breadcrumbs and various additives and the occasional flavoring, but that isn't stated. I'm sure it is somewhere. There'll be some records, but I couldn't find it. So you can imagine what was going on, basically. So this was used for those infants who were foundlings, those infants who had syphilis or any deformities of the face who couldn't feed. So we started to see that the wealthy families in Europe were experimenting with artificial feeding in the late 17th and 18th centuries. And it became acceptable as an alternative to breastfeeding in the second half, so like the 1850s. And then from here, we start seeing these diversification of these vessels and also the development of a more suitable food. So not really broth and flour mixed together. They looked at more milk-based artificial feeding. But also what we started to see was that the medical writers, again, around 1850s and onwards, started to see that artificial feeding was dangerous and it was frequently fatal for the infants. And they recommended it only as a necessity if there was no other alternative. So we started to see that there was this change and we needed to recognize that there was a change in the infant mortality, and the medical writers were saying we need something else for babies who cannot be breastfed. I mean, if we look in society now, we still got taboos of even giving the first milk, and that went through history for forever, it seems like.
I've looked after women from various cultures who don't give their baby colostrum and wait till their milk comes in.
Yep, it still happens around the world in some cultures. And really, we see as far back as sort of the 4th to the 2nd centuries BC in India that the mouth was to be cleaned with ghee and rock salt before the cord was cut.
Yeah, I've seen that.
As part of these immediate postnatal rites. And then the common thing that was given was honey from really around the world for a long time. In some parts of India, they actually would use a mixture of ghee, clarified butter, mixed with some honey and these Brahmi leaves. And then they'd mix a little bit of gold dust.
Better than fly dust.
We love a bit of dust, it seems. I mean, at least fly dust is protein. So, So we see in the Roman period, the Arabian period, there is all of this, you know, 1000 AD. The infant's first food was often honey. We see it called the purge, basically. And this taboo around colostrum was probably related to its appearance because it's different in its color and its consistency to what we consider milk or what they would have seen from milk from other animals. And basically, you know, between 1500 and the end of the 1800s, there was 49 medical writers who made recommendations about the first food of neonates. And they recommended this purge, and it normally was repeated. It wasn't a one-off. It was repeated consistently with every feed for the first 2 days or until the mother's milk had come in, because it was believed that the baby would come to harm if it was given milk while it was still passing meconium. It believed that the milk and the meconium actually coagulated in the intestines. So mostly what they would be given was butter or almond oil, and it would be combined with sugar or honey. And that was the most popular. And this is even mentioned in the Bible. But other places, they'd be giving them sugared wine or punch. some medical specialists would recommend what they called pharmaceutical purges. And this would include things like senna, castor oil, and cream of tartar.
Oh, God. So this is all aimed at clearing out the meconium, yeah?
Yep. And by golly, would it? And some have even, there's even some reports of just using salt water or Castile soap.
Ugh.
I know. How we survived as humans, we're pretty bloody hardy, to be honest.
We're pretty resilient.
We're bloody resilient, but it doesn't mean that we should do it.
Well, colostrum's a laxative anyway, isn't it?
Colostrum's totally a laxative. It's one of the many wonderful things that it does. But yeah, totally, that helps clear out the intestines. I mean, the body's perfectly designed. You know, they're feeding lots. The babies feed lots. They're taking more colostrum. The mother's milk volumes will increase quicker. You'll see that transition from this meconium towards those yellow poos much quicker. Within a couple of days. I mean, if you're not seeing those poos change to that lovely English mustard mixed with a bit of whole grain mustard effect by day four, then definitely we want to be weighing and checking this baby. Mm. So the other thing was that the mother wasn't believed to be rested or fit enough after the recovery, after her labor, to start feeding. And for some medical writers, they didn't even allow the woman to start breastfeeding until her lochia had stopped. She stopped bleeding after birth because she wasn't cleansed.
What?
So until that point, they would draw off her milk by, again, a puppy dog or another child, or that it was done with the sucking glasses. So this is really sort of 1700s. And the ideas about colostrum in Europe didn't really change until the very late 1600s. And this was actually from a midwifery textbook in France called The Accomplished Midwife. But it wasn't until really the early, about 1720s, that colostrum was recommended as more nourishing than any other milk. And then we start to see that in the mid 1700s, in an attempt to reduce morbidity and mortality from milk fever in the lying-in hospitals, this doctor, William Hunter, proposed that the infant should be put to the mother's breast within 24 hours of delivery instead of after 3 to 4 days, as had been the custom previously. And this then reduced the formerly very high incidence of milk fever to negligible proportions. And prior to this, milk fever had caused serious maternal mortality. Mm. And then what we see is also infant mortality between the ages of 0 to 28 days of age sharply fell from the 1680s until about 1840. This change was linked to giving infants colostrum.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. So we have really mucked around and played with feeding of our infants from the beginning. And, you know, we think about the 1850s of when we started to develop, you know, what we now know as infant formula as where problems set in. But actually, as women in upper societies, we weren't able to breastfeed our babies. We were told not to breastfeed our babies. We wanted to keep up with fashion. We've often looked at ways of not being able to feed our infants, or so it seems from the history. But actually, possibly there was many women just desperate to breastfeed and be with their infant as we did thousands and thousands of years ago, as nature intended. But we have caused these problems, and we can see similarities, and we can see these threads running through that we're still struggling with today. And I haven't even got on to what's going on with today. And that's all I'm going to tell you. I just wanted to go into the gruesome part of the story of this sort of breastery, so to speak.
Thank you, Katie. That was awesome. I have learned so much about breastfeeding, some of which I would rather not know. But we will not repeat them.
Thanks for listening. And I wanted to also say a huge thanks for all the 5-star love and ratings on Apple Podcasts, all the messages that you send us on Instagram, and all the shares. It is just incredible. And we are so grateful. We truly appreciate hearing from you all. Next episode is the one where we answered your questions, so stay tuned and keep sharing our bubbling cauldron of midwifery. And of course, as always, I'll leave you with some of the best bits. Oh, you could go in your wardrobe. That's meant to be good. Can you sit in the bottom of your wardrobe?
I don't actually have a wardrobe.
Yeah, the bit with clothes all around you. That's meant to be good. That's all people do.
Oh, in here?
Yeah.
Just sitting there?
Yeah. Sit in the wardrobe. Go on, do it for me.
Right. I'm not doing the whole podcast in the wardrobe. I'm just going to demonstrate to you that the sound's not any better when I make a dick of myself and sit in a wardrobe.
I didn't realise your wardrobe was like up off the ground.
It's not up off the ground. It's just not a wardrobe because it hasn't got a cover. Is that any better?
All I can see is your yoni. The bottom of your mouth.
You cannot because I've got pants on.
I know, but I mean, that's the position you're in.
Right, but can you hear me better?
Yeah.
Is it echoey?
No.
No, no, it is not.
I'm going to play this back to you. It's much better.
It's fucking not.
I need to take a picture of you in the wardrobe.
Right, that's, hang on.
No, it's perfect.
I don't believe you. I'm not going in the wardrobe. I'm prepared to lie in the bed. I'm prepared to sit in the wardrobe. But do I have to hold the microphone like this?
Yeah. Can you put it between your boobs? Okay, now talk. Talk. Leave it there and talk. Just talk for a bit. Let me just play it here.
Well, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I don't know. We're doing a podcast, so we do kind of talk about quite a lot. I love starting my mornings off like this.
I don't know what to say.
Okay, it's not. It's not much to say. Okay, great. Good.
Well, we're not doing the podcast there. We're trying to sort out where I'm going to live.
But I can't work it out unless you talk to me. I can't hear your voice.
I don't know what to talk to you about.
Just say random words. A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Do it.
I, J.
What the fuck?
I said, can't remember the nonsense of it.
I can't. You can't remember the alphabet.
H-I-W. Right, you've got my brain confuzzled now.
I've lost you. And a dog barked.
It's a puppy looking for a booby.
Whether my nipples are out, turned, in, turned, up, town, or downtown.
Uptown girl. Uptown nipple.
Uptown tits.
You've been living in a down tit world.
You'll be struck off the wet nurse Bible. There'll be no money for you.
Watch out. We better not release that. We'll have people trying to sign us up for record deals, and I haven't got time.
We're not available for record deals.
Thank you.
Wondering which of my courses is for you? Breastfeeding and Lactation, the Fundamentals has been designed for everyone working in the birthing field or those on their journey to becoming breastfeeding specialists or IBCLCs. This course gives you 7 hours of CPD and is packed with reflective learning, case studies, and some pretty tough, at times, quizzes to make sure this stuff sticks. It also means you can meet me monthly in my live Q&A. This is my course that I hope will fill in the gaps that traditional breastfeeding education has left out. I want you completing this, feeling confident to support any breastfeeding or lactation challenge of those in your care. But wait, I have another course called The Feeding Couch. Who's this for? Currently, around 80 to 96% of women decide to breastfeed during their pregnancy, but by just 8 weeks after birth, a third to almost 50% of those women have stopped breastfeeding. And of those women who stopped, 80% say they stopped breastfeeding before they wanted to. Learning about breastfeeding during pregnancy has been shown to improve breastfeeding self-confidence and improve the rate of exclusive breastfeeding in the short and the long term. I believe every mum should be able to choose how she wants to feed her baby and for how long. Knowledge is power. That's why I created the Feeding Couch, designed to be watched during pregnancy or for new mums and parents who may be struggling right now with breastfeeding. The content is in step-by-step, binge-worthy whilst pregnant or for those most tired of days postpartum, totally easy to find exactly what you need and dip in and out when you need a breastfeeding answer quickly. And for you, beautiful podcast listener, there is a 10% discount off both courses when you use the code POD10, that's P-O-D-10, at checkout. To find out more, hop on over to my website, katiejames.site, and have a look at the incredible content waiting for your lucky peepers.